And we're back with you here on this Tuesday, 16 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride, and we have got a very interesting show today. Do want to remind you, we're still giving away two tickets to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame through a trivia contest. You can call in anytime between now and Friday at 2 o'clock, Friday, May the 10th, answer a trivia question, and you'll be entered into a drawing to win two tickets to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That drawing will take place at 2 p.m. this coming Friday, May the 10th, 2:15 to be exact. So stay tuned for that. But today we've got a great guest, first-time visitor to this program. A brand new book is out today, May the 7th. The book is The Killer Across the Table. The author of this book, John Douglas, the legendary FBI criminal profiler and inspiration for the hit Netflix series Mindhunter. You all know him. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones the author of this great new book, John Douglas. John, how are you?
Very well, Scott. Thanks for having me.
John, this is such an interesting book. Tell us how the book came to be.
Well, this is about the 12th book I've done, but the big book was the first book I did in 1995 when I retired from the FBI, called Mindhunter. And after Mindhunter was published, there was so many shows spinning off of that that had nothing to do with me, or I didn't gain any financial wealth because they just used my books without contacting me. So then we had the show that was picked up. Charlize Theron bought the option, the actress Charlize Theron, and then waited about 6-7 years. And then David Fincher came forward, and I met with him, and they wanted to make it into a series. First was over to HBO, then went over to Netflix, and then the show became, you know, extremely popular. As you know, we're getting ready for season two. It'll be sometime soon, hopefully. And everyone was always interested in the interview process, and like is shown in the Mindhunter series or in the book Mindhunter. And what I do here is I take four unusual cases, and talk about how I go about conducting the interviews of each of these different, in this case, murderers, and pull back some of the experiences I had. For example, I may take something that I learned from Charles Manson and put it into the interview of, say, Donald Harvey from Ohio, who killed, you know, 70-plus patients when he was an orderly working in a hospital. So that's how, you know, that's how it came to be, and I think it'll be interesting for the for the reader.
How did you choose the four people in this book?
Well, it's just they were so different. I interviewed like one Todd Colehepp from South Carolina. I was involved with the case in about 2002, and he was only identified in 2016. I was involved because of he killed four people in a motorcycle shop. I was down lecturing at a university when the cops came up to me and said, "Hey, John, can you help us on this?" And I said, "Sure." So I looked at the case and I told them back then that this is a typically this type of case is going to be a disgruntled customer. And you'll probably find the name in the files here of these victims in this motorcycle shop. Unfortunately, the police didn't heed that advice. They focused in on an individual who showed up that day at the crime scene, and they thought his behavior was very, very suspicious. And so he focused all those years on him. Meanwhile, the subject named Todd Colehepp went on to kill several other people. He actually killed three more people. You may know the case, or your listeners, it was a case where they rescued a woman from a storage container in 2016 in South Carolina, in Spartanburg, and they rescued her, and she was able to, you know, provide the information to the police. So that was an interesting one. Another one up in New Jersey, who I interviewed at the request of the parole board, was a guy by the name of McGowan. And McGowan, he killed a brownie who's going door-to-door selling Girl Scout cookies. And so he served the maximum sentence, 30 years, and they're going to release him unless someone could find that this person was not rehabilitated, still had a propensity for violence. So I went into that prison up in Trenton, New Jersey. I spent quite a few hours with him. I told him how I wanted the room designed, where I wanted to do the interview. I wanted low lighting. I wanted comfortable furniture. I didn't want him handcuffed or leg irons. I wanted to be left alone with him. And after about 4 or 5 hours, I got him to open up, and he just really forgot who I was or who I was representing. I was representing the parole board, and he started to describe to me in detail that day when he heard a knock on the screen door, and he was living with his mother and his mother and his grandmother. His mother was off to work, and he was a school teacher, and it was over the Easter break. And he said, "John, when I heard the knock on that screen door, I knew I was going to kill her." And this girl was she was 7 years of age. So he goes through all this, the details, and I describe that in the book that's out right now. It was amazing the information he provided to me, including he started whispering to me because he didn't want anyone to hear the secrets he was about to tell me. And one of the secrets was that he had money. And I said, "How do you get money when you're in here?" And he said, and he whispered, and he said, "I got money when my mother died, when my grandmother died, when they sold the house. I got this money, and I put the money out of state." "Well, why'd you put the money out of state?" I asked him, and he said, "Because this way the victims' families can't get any of the money." And he went on to say how much it was. It was over $600,000. And he said after he got out, he was going to go up to New York. But it was amazing how he, during the interview, how he just, it was freezing in the cell that where I was with him. And he was shaking and sweating at the same time as he was repeating over and over again all the details of on that particular day and what he did to that to that victim. And it was just it was an amazing. So those were two of the four, and each one of them are just interesting, you know, in their own ways. And it educates me and law enforcement when you start studying this behavior to apply what you're learning to other cases that you may have, and maybe how to conduct an interview with them or an interrogation with them. And so this is what I've been doing while I was in the Bureau. As you know from the show Criminal Minds, we have my character Holden Ford going into the prisons doing these interviews, and which is exactly what I did, but only for survival, because I was the youngest FBI agent really in all of headquarters when I came back to Quantico after working in the Detroit, Milwaukee field offices, and came back, and I did it to be a good instructor now in the classroom, because the instructors were being challenged by police officers who work cases, like someone could have worked the Manson case or David Berkowitz case, the son of Sam in New York, and they would challenge the instructors, "Hey, man, I've worked the case." So I sat in the back of the class and said, "Oh my goodness, I have to, when I get the opportunity, go into prisons and see if I can learn from them and maybe be a more credible instructor." So it started there, but then it just morphed into something bigger and bigger, where I became a program manager and became a unit chief and had 40-something people, you know, working with me. So that's how it all started.
John, I think it's very interesting that all human beings on Earth have the physical capability to kill somebody. Now, thank God most of us don't.
Yeah.
Is there anything, any thread at all, even though all cases are unique, that all killers have?
Well, yeah. Well, the ones pretty much that I interviewed and the case I work with, predatory types, and almost without exception, when you start digging into the backgrounds of them, you find you don't find them coming from any loving, nurturing early childhood. It's just the opposite of that. You'll find abuse of some type, sexual, physical, psychological abuse or neglect, abandonment, as well. And then it's not that everyone who comes from that type of background will be turn out to be a violent offender, but all I'm saying is from the people who I interviewed, these young children who are receiving this type of abuse, they don't have much of a chance. And so what you begin to see early on is you start seeing acts of violence. And one of the big ones, and I've spoken to SPCAs around the country, particularly up in Canada, where their group investigates animal cruelty. And I found that animal cruelty was a big stepping stone for many of these offenders. Even Donald Harvey, who's in this book, The Killer Across the Table, from the Ohio area, and when he was killing patients, when I did interviews with him, he was describing to me how the different animals he killed as a kid growing up, and neighbor's cow, how he cut the cow's throat, and it's just kind of nonchalant, just kind of a matter of fact. So you start seeing that, you start seeing even fire setting, which is another form of, it's not a sexual thing so much as a power. These crimes are really of power and anger, maybe displaced anger. And these indicators will start showing up where school teachers will come up to me and say, "Hey, John, I see some of these indicators right now in a student in my classroom." And unfortunately, if there's no interception of this child, there's no counseling or of some type, and this child just kind of moves on from elementary school, say, up into middle school, high school, I mean, we're going to see him in law enforcement. And now, this is not to say that I feel sorry for them. I do feel sorry for the early childhood, what they went through. But by the time I'm interviewing them, it comes down to free will and choices that they made. And in fact, when I was interviewing Todd Kohlhepp, he was a bright individual. But when he was 14 years of age, 15 years of age, he rapes a 14-year-old girl and spends 15 years in prison in his teenage years. 15 now are spent in a man's prison. When he gets out, comes back to South Carolina, smart guy, picks up a real estate license, broker's license, two college degrees, private pilot's license. Then he goes on this killing spree, and he wants to know what makes him tick. And I said, it was predictable, the background he had, because his mother abandoned him, father didn't want anything to do with him, bouncing in and out of different families, started acting out early on. And I said, but Todd, you still knew right from wrong. You knew the nature and consequences of your actions. You were able to make the choices, and you made the bad choices. So, I mean, where you are today, it was predictable, but, I have no forgiveness for what you did.
In all these interviews over the years, Charles Manson, Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, has there ever been anything that shocked you, took you back in any of these interviews?
Well, it's difficult. Ed Kemper, who's featured in the Mindhunter series, big guy, 6'9", 300 pounds. And he killed seven co-eds, his mother, his grandparents, a neighbor. And it's just like how smart, how articulate he was. He really shouldn't have ended up where he was. And he was really a product of this early childhood abuse by his mother. His mother hated him. He reminded her of a husband who she divorced and despised him. He looked like the husband. So that was unusual. And then another one was named Bittaker. And Bittaker was started off as a serial rapist in California. And when in prison, he met another rapist named Norris. And so there, together they would fantasize, and I would end up interviewing Bittaker, but they would fantasize that when they got out of prison, when they were rehabilitated, supposedly, they would then go out and rape and murder a teenager for every year of a teenager's life, and they ended up going through and raped about six or seven teenagers. During the interview with them, and he was just so matter of fact. I was with a female agent. He never would look at the agent, female agent. She'd ask a question. He would look at look at me. His nickname was Pliers Bittaker, and the reason for that, his nickname in prison was Pliers Bittaker, because when they would abduct these girls, they had a van. They called the Murder Mac, and they insulated the van, and it was a windowless van, kind of commercial style of van, which is kind of the vehicle of choice that we began to see with a lot of these predators. And they would audio tape the torturing of the victims and scripting them to say things as if they were enjoying the torture. It was horrific, and he would discuss this with me just as if it was nothing. It's just like, where do you want to go to lunch? And the only time you seem to get to them, him and others, is when you start digging deep into the relationships, again, going back to family, the relationships that they did not have. And mostly, it's always the mom. It's always the mother thing. The father may be absent, or if he's there, he's passive, but it's always a mother thing. And that's what he started kind of welling up with tears, surprisingly. But everything else, all these horrific crimes that, and the tapes, are horrible. I use them in instruction of police, and in fact, I even let Scott Glenn listen to him when they made the movie Silence of the Lambs, and he was portraying my part in the movie. He got welled up with tears, and he said, "John, I never knew there were people like this." He said, "You know, I was against the death penalty, but I just don't see how people like this, you know, why we should keep them alive." And I said, "Well, Scott, I just want you to hear this," and I said, "This is serious business that I and my colleagues are dealing with here, and most of us here have had our own health issues trying to deal with the nature of the work and the stress and dealing with the victims of these crimes and interviewing the subjects of them. So that's why I want you to listen," and I made him listen to it, and it actually bothered him. Later on, I would speak to him years later, and he said how it really bothered him to listen to those tapes.
Mm. We're chatting. We got about 3 more minutes here with John Douglas, legendary FBI criminal profiler and inspiration for the hit Netflix series Mindhunter, author of the new book The Killer Across the Table, which is on sale today, May the 7th. John, do you like writing books? And kind of take us through an interview, because that's what this book is about, interviews.
Yeah.
Is there a process?
Yeah. The book is, I have a co-writer, but I'm an instructor, so it's just I basically instruct my co-writer in presenting the material. As far as the interview, when I address it in the book, that really it is not an interview, and it's not an interrogation where we have facts, you know, representing the facts, and we got you type of thing, or interview where I'm trying to get information for this. What I found is you have to have a conversation. It's more of a conversation, and when you get to the conversation, the subjects you're talking to are asking questions about me, which I'll tell them. They'll want to know about my personal life, or what it was like, what's like in the bureau, or in the FBI, and things along those lines. But the main thing that has come out over the years, and people are surprised, is that, and it's not really portrayed correctly in Mindhunter, is I don't go in with a tape recorder. I don't go in with notes. I don't have any of that information. What I say is it's to understand the artist, you must look at the crime. When you understand the artist, you look at the artwork. To understand the criminal, you look at the crime. So before I interview the criminal, I go through the case every which way. I look at the crime scene photographs and go through the autopsy protocol photographs. And pretty much have the case down pat when I go in there. And the reason I don't use notes I don't want to lose eye contact. I don't want to have a tape recorder on either. We tried it early on when we first interviewed Ed Kemper, and these people are very paranoid. They're paranoid. They don't trust anyone, which makes sense within the prison system. They don't trust correctional officers. They don't trust us. So, you know, it's like, what are you going to do with that tape? What notes are you taking over there? So you don't use any of this. And the other thing is, it's still being made. Mistakes are being made today. Is that many people who are interviewing these people for the subjects for probation or parole or treatment, they rely on self-reporting. They don't want to look at the crime scene photographs. They don't want that information. That to me, it's critical. They want to rely on self-reporting. It's like, hey, Joe, how do you feel today? Do you still have the urge, to go out? You want to rape, or you want to go molest children? No, doc. I don't have the urge. Well, you learn a lot from studying the crime, analyzing the case, and you must do that. But they'll come back and tell you, they being in the psychologist or the people doing those interviews, well, it'll prejudice me. I want to rely on my training. in school to learn to know if there's deception. Well, unless you have some characteristic that's a lot better than mine, I'll tell him. Because I was fooled early on. I went in there not armed with that information or partially armed, and they test you. But once they see that you know their case, and you can also, you kind of stop them when sometimes they'll project blame away from themselves onto the victim, or they'll come up with some excuse, abuse work, and you just kind of chuckle with them and say, "Hey, come on, you know, man, I looked at the case, I know the case. I mean, but I don't put them down. It's just that I become kind of like an associate and friend with them. I'm trying to gain information and collect information again that I can apply to the cases that when I was in the Bureau, that we were receiving yearly 1,000 cases a year. Since I've been out of the Bureau, I do it now. I've helped free people as well. I helped free Damien Echols and Jesse Miskelly, Jason Baldwin, known as the West Memphis Three, West Memphis, Arkansas, three teens who were wrongfully convicted of killing 3 8-year-olds. I helped Amanda Knox get out of prison in Italy, and I was just on a panel with both of them up in New York City. I did the JonBenet Ramsey case, applied it there against the Bureau, against who they thought was responsible, against the police, and I believe the family, and to this day, were not responsible for the murders of JonBenet Ramsey. So you go, you know, if I felt they were guilty, I'd say they were guilty, but they were not, you know, guilty. So it's used differently now today than I wasn't able to do that when I was in the Bureau. We couldn't do cases like the West Memphis Three or Amanda Knox case. We couldn't help defense attorneys. But now out of the Bureau, if I see a case where there's a wrongful conviction or false confession, you know, I'll try to help if I can.
John, final question to you here, and I appreciate the time today. In a case like Amanda Knox, because that's kind of fascinating, in a case like JonBenet Ramsey, how do you know or come to think that these people are innocent?
It's evidence. I mean, it's just, there's pre-offense behavior we look at. We look at post-offense behavior, but also there's evidence. And in both those cases, what happened was, there was evidence there that would take the investigations often in a totally different direction. But they were letting a theory drive an investigation, letting theories drive it and not letting evidence. Or if they had a piece of evidence that would support the theory, they'd accept it. If there was a piece that did not accept the theory, they discard it. And in the case of JonBenet Ramsey, a case, and I got to interview the parents, I got to conduct my own investigation there, and with the late Detective Lou Smith, who went into the case thinking that they were guilty. Later on, he said no, that they were not responsible. Amanda Knox, they got the guy who killed Meredith Kircher. His name is Rudy Gaudet. All blood, all fingerprints at the scene. Feces left in the toilet were from Rudy Gaudet. But you had a prosecutor who was trying to make something out of this, like that it was some kind of satanic murder, and where three people are involved in this case, and which was just hogwash. And the thing about it is that tabloid journalism over in Italy and in parts of Europe were then picked up by legitimate news, newspapers and other media venues, and then it came over to this country, picked up by legitimate newspaper outlets and television, and we became prejudiced. The public was becoming prejudiced. I said, "Oh yeah, she did it. Look at her. Look at, she's kissing a boyfriend, and her roommate was just murdered." So it's experience, but you got to let you let theories. You can have a theory, but let's go with the evidence. Go with the forensic, evidence, and let that drive the investigation. Mm.
Very interesting. The legendary FBI criminal profiler and inspiration for the hit Netflix TV series Mindhunter, John Douglas, has been the guest in his book, The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking the Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators with the FBI's Original Mindhunter, is available today. John, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for the time.
Hey, Scott, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.
Wow. How about that? interesting stuff going on all around the world. John Douglas, how many of you have seen Mindhunter on Netflix? Interesting book, The Killer Across the Table. Well, we've got time here for some trivia. We've got about 19 minutes left before the top of the hour, so let's see if we can get some more people registered here. We have trivia questions left over from yesterday, and actually two new trivia questions that we will add today. Okay, here's the ones left over from yesterday, and again, the telephone line, 740-383-9944. In the 1980s, in the USA Today newspaper, there was a contest. It was about a fictional cartoon character that was aimed at children. Now, what happened is it was said that this person was lost, and you had to enter a trivia question. You had to answer a trivia question to find this character. Who was this lost person? Go ahead, caller.
Has anybody guessed Garfield yet?
You know, Garfield was the last guest yesterday. It was not Garfield.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Not Garfield, but it is a fictional cartoon character that was lost. Now, who was that fictional cartoon character that was lost? And what you did was USA Today printed a clue. And as a child, you answered the clue and you mailed it into USA Today. This would have been the 1980s. And if you answered the clue right, they printed your name in the USA Today newspaper. But what we're looking for is that fictional cartoon character that was lost, that was the subject of a USA Today contest in the 1980s. That's question number one. Other questions we did not get answered yesterday. Where would you buy a hamburger in the early 1900s? Now, I'm talking about a fully made hamburger. Bun, hamburger, the whole bit. If you wanted one that was already made in the early 1900s, where would be your best place to go get an already made hamburger? That's still out there. McDonald's. McDonald's, in their early days of being open, did not want something in their lobbies. There was something they really did not want in their lobbies and lobbied against it for a long time. What did McDonald's restaurant not want in their lobbies in the early days of McDonald's? And then we've got two of these answered yesterday as we were going off the air. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three foods every year? Now, yesterday we got beef and potatoes, but we don't have the third. What? McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three foods every year? We've already got beef and potatoes. What's the other one? 740-383-9944. So the questions from yesterday. What is McDonald's the largest purchaser of every year? What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies when they first opened? Where would you have bought a hamburger, a fully made hamburger, in the early 1900s? And what well-known cartoon character was the subject of a USA Today contest in the 1980s, trying to find somebody who was lost? 740-383-9944. Go ahead, caller.
Would that third item be cooking oil?
Not cooking oil. I don't know if they use much of that at McDonald's.
Oh.
I think they might just throw it on the grill.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah, the question is, McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three items every year? We've got beef and potatoes. What is the third one? 740-383-9944. Who's the cartoon character that was lost in the USA Today newspaper? Who was that? Go ahead, caller.
Your McDonald's question, would the third one be buns?
Not buns, but that's a good guess as well.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Not buns. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three items every year? We've got beef and potatoes. What is the third item that they're the largest purchaser of every year? What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies when they first opened up? Go ahead, caller.
McDonald's largest purchaser, pickles?
Not pickles. Nope, thank you. No, not pickles. What is McDonald's the largest purchaser of every year? There are three items. We've got two. We've got beef and we've got potatoes, but we don't have the third one yet. What is the third one? Go ahead, caller.
I'm going to guess for McDonald's coffee beans.
Not coffee beans.
Okay.
Thank you, though. No, it is not coffee beans. It's a good question, though, isn't it? McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three items every year? We've got beef, we've got potatoes, but we don't have the third one yet. What is the third one? Go ahead, caller.
Would it be the largest purchaser of soft drinks?
Not soft drinks.
All right.
All right, it's not soft drinks. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of three foods every year. Beef and potatoes are two of them. What's the third one? What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies when they first opened up? Does anybody know what that answer is? Go ahead, caller. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to guess chicken.
Not chicken.
Okay.
Thank you. Not chicken. What did McDonald's not want in their restaurant lobbies when they first opened up? Does anybody know that? What did they not want in their lobbies? If you wanted a hamburger in the early 1900s, where would you go? Go ahead, caller.
Is McDonald's the largest purchaser of cups?
Not cups.
I think.
No, not cups. If you wanted a hamburger in the early 1900s, where would you have gone? If you wanted to buy a fully formed hamburger with bun and burger, where would have been your best bet to buy it? Go ahead, caller.
Okay, would you purchase hamburgers in a diner?
Not a diner.
Okay.
They actually did not sell them in... they actually did not sell hamburgers in diners in the early 1900s, and there was a reason for that. And I'll tell you the reason if we get the answer. But the question is, if you wanted a fully prepared hamburger in the early 1900s, where would you have gone to get that hamburger? Go ahead, caller.
I'm thinking I might have figured this out. Is McDonald's the largest purchaser of condiments?
Not condiments.
Oh.
Nope.
Crap.
Good guess. Thank you. No, it was not condiments. The question we're looking for here, McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three foods every year? Now, we've got beef and we've got potatoes, but there is a third. Does anybody know what the third is? Go ahead, caller.
Okay, McDonald's, I'm going to take, say, buns.
Not buns.
Okay.
Not buns. What is that other item that McDonald's is the largest purchaser of every year? What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies when they first opened up? There was something that McDonald's restaurants did not want in their lobbies when they first opened up. If you were going to buy a hamburger, a fully prepared hamburger in the early 1900s, where would you have bought it? Not a diner. And when I get the answer, I'll tell you why it wasn't a diner. Go ahead, caller.
Are they the largest purchaser for fish?
Not fish.
Thanks, Scott.
Nope. It was not fish. Boy, we're bound and determined to get this today. We've got about 11 minutes left. 49 minutes past the hour here. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of what three foods every year? Now, we've already got two. We've got beef and we've got potatoes. But what is the third one? Go ahead, caller.
How about pies, Scott?
Not pies.
Hmm.
No. Good guess, though. Thank you. It is not pies. What is McDonald's the largest purchaser of every year? There are three foods that McDonald's is the largest purchaser of. Now, beef and potatoes are two of those. But what is the third one? What did McDonald's not want in their restaurants in the early days? Go ahead, caller.
McDonald's, would it be lettuce?
Not lettuce.
Okay.
Thank you. It is not lettuce. What did McDonald's not want in their restaurants in the early days of being open? Does anybody know that? Go ahead, caller.
How about cheese?
Not cheese. Thank you. We're going around McDonald's today, that's for sure. No, it was not cheese. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of three items every year. One is beef, one is potatoes. What is the item that we're missing? That's what we're looking for. Go ahead, caller.
Eggs.
What's that?
Eggs.
Nope, not eggs. It is not eggs. Boy, this is a popular question today. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of three items every year. Beef, potatoes, and what is the third item? Go ahead, caller.
Scott, would it be Thousand Island dressing?
Not Thousand Island dressing, but I bet they go through a lot of it.
I bet they do. Thank you.
Thank you. No, it's not Thousand Island dressing. This is interesting. What is McDonald's the largest purchaser of every year? Beef, potatoes, and one other item. Go ahead, caller.
Would it be soda pop?
Not soda pop.
Okay.
It's not soda pop. We've got beef, we've got potatoes, but we don't have the third one yet. The third item that McDonald's is the largest purchaser of every year. Does anybody know what McDonald's did not want in their restaurant lobbies in the beginning? Go ahead, caller.
Dairy products.
Not dairy products. No, it's not dairy products. Does anybody know what McDonald's did not want in their lobbies when they first opened up? They really did not like these things. Where would you get a hamburger in the early 1900s? If you wanted a fully prepared hamburger, where would you go? Go ahead, caller.
Hi, is the other product that McDonald's buys the most of, is it pork?
It is pork. How did you know that?
Because my husband absolutely loves their sausage McMuffin, so
you know,
gets them all the time.
You know, it's funny that we went around egg, and it's pork. It's because they serve sausage, so many sausage McMuffins. I think they're one of the biggest breakfast providers in the country.
They are, and they're on the dollar menu, and they don't have eggs on them. So I was thinking, well, it's got to be pork, you know, and bacon, you know.
It absolutely, and they also, I think, do sides of sausage at McDonald's.
Yeah, they sausage biscuits and gravy. Yep, they do.
Absolutely. Would you like to be entered in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame contest?
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
All right. What is your name?
It's Jennifer Vargo.
Okay, Jennifer. I tell you what. We're in this contest continues on through Friday, and you can answer as many questions as you want to get as many chances at winning the contest on Friday as you want. So call in again.
I definitely will. Thanks so much. You have a great day.
Thank you, Jennifer. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yes, it is pork, and I'm guessing it's pork because, as Jennifer told us there, because of the sausage McMuffins, sausage biscuits and gravy, and all the things that they serve at McDonald's. So, McDonald's is the purchaser of what three foods each year? The largest purchaser, beef, pork, and potatoes. Go ahead, caller.
Was the thing that McDonald's didn't want in their restaurant trash cans?
Not trash cans, but, you know, sometimes you wonder when you go into a McDonald's if they still want trash cans there.
Yeah, that's what I don't want in there.
I don't know.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Not trash cans. It's an interesting question, though. In the early days of McDonald's, there was something that McDonald's did not want in their lobbies. What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies in the early days? Also, I'm surprised we haven't gotten this one. In the early 1900s, if you wanted a hamburger, where would you go get it at? Go ahead, caller.
A sitting area.
Well, you know, that's kind of close.
Schools?
Well, really, they did not want those. You're exactly right. They didn't want stools in a sitting area because they didn't want a certain thing in their lobbies.
Okay.
But you're on the right track.
Okay, so it's not the sitting area. Restrooms?
No, I think they always wanted restrooms.
They had those.
Yeah,
okay.
But here's how I want to explain this. They did not want the sitting areas. They didn't want the stools, but it was because they didn't want something else. They didn't want those things because of something else.
So people leaving stuff on the table that they'd have to clean.
I don't think they wanted that either, but it all had to do with this. You're on the right track.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that is very close.
It is true, McDonald's did not want a sitting area. McDonald's did not want stools, and they didn't want people to leave trash on the tables, but it's because they didn't want this certain thing in their lobbies. What was it? Go ahead, caller.
Okay, did McDonald's not want the booths?
They didn't want those either, but it was all because they didn't want this certain thing.
Okay.
Keep thinking. Yes, it does have to do with stools, it has to do with booths, it has to do with trash on the tables, but it all goes back to one thing that they didn't want, and that's why they didn't want those things. And it's changed over the years, but it's interesting. Go ahead, caller.
They didn't want varmints like bugs and mice?
You know, I'm sure they didn't. But I don't know how many of them were using the booths and the stools at the time.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
You would be. It happens from time to time.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's true. I'm sure they didn't want the vermin. But it does have to do with stools, booths, trash, the whole bit. But it was all symptomatic of a bigger problem, of something they did not want. What did McDonald's not want in the beginning? Go ahead, caller.
Okay, they didn't want the little bars like they set out with the stools.
Yeah, same thing. They didn't want that because they didn't want something else. And those things would have caused this.
Okay.
Keep thinking. Here we are, 57 and a half minutes past the hour. Are we going to get this? What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies in the early days? Where would you buy a hamburger in the early 1900s? That's kind of interesting. Go ahead, caller.
Tables.
Not tables, but that's on the right track. It's not, but they didn't want tables either because they were afraid the tables, the booths, the countertops, all that would lead to something that they didn't want. What did McDonald's not want in their lobbies in the early days of McDonald's? Go ahead, caller.
Since they didn't want tables in the stores, how about, I know a lot of people now gathers around for coffee. Did they not want people sitting around?
You got it. They did not want loitering. They did not.
Okay.
They did not want people to stick around and hang around because they thought that if they did that, that's why they would come in and they wouldn't buy more.
Mm-hmm.
You've got it. Would you like to be entered in the contest?
Yes, I would.
Okay, what's the name?
Ruth.
Ruth?
Haas.
All right, Ruth, you are in. And like I was telling Jennifer earlier on, you can enter as many times as you like up through Friday.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Yes, isn't that interesting? McDonald's did not want loitering in their lobbies in the early days. They did not want people to stick around. Now, that's totally different now. They've got Wi-Fi and tables and booths and coffee areas. But in the early days, they thought people would not buy more if they just hung around. They didn't want loitering. All right, we've got about a minute left here. Does anybody know where you could buy a hamburger in the early 1900s, the bread and the burger? If you wanted to buy a hamburger, where was the most likely place you could go do that? Also, we still have the question. In the 1980s, USA Today newspaper did a contest looking for a famous cartoon character who was lost. And how this went was, a clue was given in the USA Today newspaper. You wrote in, answered the clue. If you got it right, you won the contest, and you were put in the newspaper. Who was that cartoon character? Go ahead, caller.
Okay, could they buy a hamburger maybe in the old country store?
Not the country stores.
Okay.
Thank you. Not the country stores. If you wanted to buy a hamburger in the early 1900s, where would you go to do it? And I'll tell you why it was not a diner if we get this right. Go ahead, caller.
If you wanted to buy a hamburger back in the 1900s, would it have been a fair? Go to the fair, carnival?
You know, you could have bought them at fairs, but you didn't have to go to fairs, but these things were at fairs.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. You could have bought them at a fair because these things were available at fairs, but they were also available other places. They're still available other places. We'll take one more guess today. Where could you buy a hamburger in the early 1900s if you wanted one, or who was the cartoon character in USA Today newspaper? Go ahead, caller.
All right, to buy the hamburger, was it the ballpark?
Not the ballpark, but that's a good guess, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, those two questions survive. Where would you buy a hamburger in the early 1900s, and who was that cartoon character that was lost in the 80s on USA Today? I tell you what, we're going to take... Okay, we'll take one more call, and then we're going to take a break. So stay with us here on WWGH Radio. Okay, one more call today. Oh, if that was you, call back in real quick. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. We'll take one more guest today. Go ahead, caller.
Could you buy it from somebody on the street, like a little place to cook it, vendor-like thing?
That's it, a street vendor.
Yeah, and it was like, I was trying to think when I was growing up, and I thought diner, that's the first thing, and then I thought, well, it had to be... If it wasn't the country store, something earlier, maybe, so...
The reason that they didn't sell them in diners is because diners thought they were a low-class meal, and that's why they weren't sold in diners.
Now, that's where we got them.
Yeah, it's interesting that it changed. It certainly changed then. All right, I'll put your name in, and thanks for calling.
Okay, thanks. Okay, bye.
We're going to break. Stay tuned.
Being against bad trade bills and being... for jobs for Americans, and it's right on immigration.